This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Jeremy, before we go any further, I just want to give a hat tip to a mutual friend who died a year ago. You were kind enough to put me in touch with Keith Harmon Snow, who came onto my show, I don't know, about a year and a half ago to chat to me about his experience with the Rwandan quote-unquote genocide. And thank you for putting me in touch with him. And I hope that wherever he is now, he is out of that pain of the cancer that eventually took him.
Yeah, Keith was a wonderful man, and we really miss him. And he was an amazing journalist who really got the truth. He traveled in many different African and Asian countries, and he got the true story. You know, he did the legwork, the groundwork, interviewed many people, and he punctured a lot of myths that are promoted in U.S. and Western media. And he exposed the Rwandan genocide fraud, basically. The story that the Tutsi were the only victims, and that Paul Kagame was this heroic figure who saved the country from these evil Hutu genocidists. I mean, he told the full story, really, was how the Tutsi had illegally invaded Rwanda. I mean, there were problems stemming from the colonial era had accentuated division between the Hutu and Tutsi. And the Tutsi aristocracy, I think, had been in power in the colonial era by the Belgians and mistreated the Hutu and treated them like slaves. And then when the country achieved independence, you had a Hutu power revolution. Then a lot of the Tutsi were put into exile. They had certain legitimate grievances, but they invaded the country illegally. And then Kagame was the one. What Harmon Snow showed was that, and there are others whose work he drew upon for this, was that it was Kagame. There was a peace-sharing agreement that was being worked out in Arusha in the 90s to end the civil war that had been triggered by an illegal RPF, Rwandan Patriotic Front, the Tutsi invasion that was backed by the United States. Because what Snow showed also was that the U.S. and RPF began to function as a U.S.-UK proxy, and that the French had supported the Hutu regime of Juvenal Habyarimana. So it was really the great game playing out between France and Great Britain. And U.S.-UK had sponsored this illegal invasion. And then Kagame, Snow showed that it was Kagame who shot down the aircraft of Juvenal Habyarimana to basically hijack these peace talks, which would have set up some kind of power-sharing agreement, which could resolve this conflict and led to an era of peace. But the Tutsi wanted full control over the RPF, wanted full control over the country, and that was the design of the US-UK. And a lot of the killing, the Tutsi and RPF forces committed a lot of the atrocities. I mean, yes, the Hutu Interahamwe committed atrocities against Tutsi, but it was not just one side that the media presented. It was atrocities on both sides. And actually, Kagame, RPF may have allowed a lot of the atrocities to take place to exploit them for propaganda purposes. And the goal was to take over the country, and then they invaded the Congo. The U.S., U.K. were intent on using RPF as a tool to plunder the Congo and then open it up for Western corporations. And so the Clinton administration and U.K. Major and Blair administration supported the RPF and Kagame invasion of Congo, which caused millions of deaths and some of the worst atrocities imaginable. So that's what, Snow, that was the kind of overall narrative he presented. And he had, firsthand interviews, and he just kind of challenged the mythology about the Tutsi, the good guy, the Hutu, the bad guy, and showed the underlying geopolitical intrigues. And he exposed the bankruptcy of the Western intellectuals who just promoted pro-RPF propaganda and distorted the nature of the conflict.
Okay, now, as it happens, Jeremy, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, that the average Westerner doesn't care about Rwanda. They don't even know where Rwanda is. So for the sake of clarity, would you mind just quickly giving me the official story so that we can compare?
Okay, well, the official story was that, the RPF were presented in a very noble light. This is the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Because the RPF had been set up, you know, when the Hutu power revolution took root in the late 50s, early 60s, when Rwanda gained its independence, because the Tutsi had been elevated by the Belgians and treated the Hutu very badly. So then when they gained their independence, it was a Hutu power movement that took power and expelled the Tutsi. And then they organized the Rwandan Patriotic Front in exile in Uganda and Tanzania. And, I mean, it should be acknowledged that the Tutsi were often mistreated in those countries. They were treated more like second-class citizens, and they were, they lived pretty marginally and impoverished. I mean, I knew some Tutsi refugees myself, and they had a harsh upbringing. So I can understand perhaps the desire to get back to Rwanda and reestablish, you know, their lives there. But, they did carry out an illegal invasion from Uganda to invade, which was supported by the U.S. government, which poured in a huge amount of military support into Uganda, whose government under Yoweri Museveni was supporting the RPF. And that's what triggered a civil war. But that story, I think, is not well understood. I think the dominant narrative is just this kind of simple narrative that the Tutsi are the good guys and these evil Hutu forces, you know, spread anti-Tutsi hate and massacred, up to a million Tutsi and perpetrated this horrific genocide, and that Kagame led the RPF forces to save the country and save his people from genocide and establish democracy. I mean, Bill Clinton called him one of the great men of democracy, yet he's been in power for the last 30 years or something and has killed off many of his opponents. They have death squads that operate even in European countries and murder people. He's murdered thousands of people, including a lot of dissidents. So, yeah, the official story is just kind of fairy tale. And, yeah, I mean, you had this movie Hotel Rwanda, which I think advanced a simplistic narrative. And it doesn't look at the larger history or the geopolitical intrigues and how the US-UK were using the RPF for their own agenda to gain a foothold in mineral-rich Central Africa.
Yeah, and, I mean, the idea is also that the Tutsis were the minority and, you know, the Hutus would come after them. Because they were the minority, but it doesn't quite work like that because the Tutsis had a lot of Western backing.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, from my research, what I found was that initially the U.S. government actually supported it, and the CIA was supporting Habyarimana because the Tutsi were viewed as being backed by communist China and were seen as leftists in the 60s. After they had been expelled in exile, and they were organizing into guerrilla units, and there may have been some support from the Chinese, and their leaders in that era were more left-leaning, and I think they had been supportive of a pro-Lumumba's rebellion in the Congo. So the CIA actually was supporting, and I have evidence from my book, Modernizing Repression, which was a study of Cold War-era police training programs and clandestine operation by the CIA based on a lot of research in the National Archives. I found documents on Rwanda where the CIA was actually training directly Habyarimana, who became the leader, who led Rwanda from the Hutu leader from 1973, I believe, until his plane was shot down in 1994. He had been the chief of police under the previous regime of Gregoire Kayibanda, who was a Hutu leader. And the CIA, who was training police forces in African countries, they actually directly worked with Habyarimana when he was the chief of police. And then he became head of state in 1973. But then a shift occurred because I studied government documents in depth and went to different presidential libraries. And what I found in the Reagan library, there were documents where they were starting to complain. The State Department was starting to complain about Javier Mena, that he was he was leaning more to the left and the socialist camp by the 80s, and they said his government is too much bureaucracy, and it was just more of a state-owned economy. With more, it wasn't purely socialist, but it was leaning in that direction with a lot of government-owned industry, and the U.S. was intent on privatizing the economies of and opening them up to foreign investment. So they lost affinity for Javier Mena, who they had supported in the past. And I think they decided in the 80s and 90s to support the Rwandan Patriotic Front in exile and to develop this scheme to take back the country and to use Rwanda as a platform for gaining influence. Because the big prize of the Congo, with all its mineral wealth, and the diamond, the cobalt, the coltan, there's not that much in Rwanda, very little. It's all in the Congo. But, in the Cold War, the U.S. Government had supported Joseph Mobutu, who was a dictator who ruled in the interest of Western, mining corporations. Like this guy named Maurice Templesman, who just died this year. He was a big donor to the Democratic Party and was on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a CIA cutout that spreads political propaganda. He was on its board. He was a billionaire in the diamond industry, and he owned Templesman and Sons Diamond Company, and he worked with the De Beers Diamond Corporation, and he had a huge foothold in the diamond industry and other mining ventures in the Congo. and he was very close with the CIA and involved in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, and was close with Joseph Mobutu, was a liaison between the CIA and Mobutu, which the CIA fortified for years. But then in the 90s, Mobutu got cancer and was dying, so they had to think of the future. Who's going to replace Mobutu and give Templesman and his friends access to that diamond wealth? So that's why I think they saw the importance of the RPF, having a proxy in Rwanda that could, basically manipulate the politics. Because Rwanda invaded Congo twice in the 90s. After Mobutu fell, and also they basically imposed a Quisling leader, Joseph Kabila, who ruled Congo, I forget the exact years, but up until pretty recently, he was a long-standing ruler in the early 2000s through the 2010s. His real name was Hippolyte Kanembe. He was adopted by Laurent Kabila, who was the Congolese leader, but he was actually a Rwandan, and he was viewed as a Rwandan Quisling that was imposed by these Rwandan invasions, funded by the U.S. and U.K. And he opened the economy. He favored Western corporation as well as Rwanda and Uganda were able to plunder Congo's mineral wealth for themselves. And if you go to Rwanda, the capital is glistening. There's a lot of poverty in the country, but there is an elite in Rwanda that has made out very, very well from plundering the resources of Congo. And they basically had a Rwandan Quisling running the country for many years, this guy Hippolyte Kanembe, and he was the new Mobutu. And a lot of Clinton's friends, some of Clinton's donors got choice concessions, and companies like Barrick Gold, that there were Clintonites on the board, and George H.W. Bush was on the board of that huge mining corporation, and they got major concessions. So that was the agenda, but this is kind of lost. The media narrative never goes into that aspect of politics and framed this kind of simple narrative of evil Hutu and good Tutsi. And really, again, the atrocities, you know, the Tutsi forces committed horrendous atrocities from the start, from the time of their illegal invasion from Uganda in 1990, which triggered the civil war, up through their invasions of Congo. And, you know, they hunted the Hutu down in the forest, claiming, you know, they were all genocidists. You know, they used that to justify massacring tens of thousands of Hutu in the forest. They chased them out of Rwanda and then massacred them in the forests, horrific atrocities, and forced them into refugee camps and then starved them. So we're talking about, you know, just horrific atrocities and human rights abuses. But the human rights industry was so corrupt, it only largely focused on the Hutu crime and ignored these crimes that were sponsored by the U.S. and UK governments.
The genocide claim is a myth. There was no deliberate attempt for one tribe, like the Hutus or the Tutsis, to wipe out the other. What actually transpired was civil war that ended up with just chaos across the board.
Correct. They tried to claim that there was a genocide fact. You see, and we see patterns from other conflicts where you have this disinformation and fabricated evidence. So in this case, you know, we had false weapons of mass destruction, false chemical gas attacks by Assad, Gaddafi, false story that he's, you know, giving Viagra to his troops so they would commit rapes. So here the falsehood is this genocide facts. They allegedly found, like, 2 years later. And, you know, there was no evidence at the time of a planned genocide, you know, because that's the narrative we get, that this is, you know, I mean, the Nazis, there's the Wannsee Conference. You know, that's the evidence that the Nazis had a plan for the final solution, that they were going to take the Jews from the ghettos and send them to the concentration camps and have the gas ovens. And you can point to this Wannsee Conference where there was planning for this. And, you know, Eichmann was a key planner, and that's why he was put on trial. In this case, they want to claim that there was a genocide facts by some of these Hutu leaders that shows this intent and plan to exterminate them. But that was proven to have been a manipulated document, a fabrication. I have an article where I discuss this, and I can't remember all the details specifically, but they off the top of my head, it's in that article I wrote, because it's been a number of years since I wrote it. But they attributed to, like, it was very shady, like they attributed to this guy who was like a defector or something, and then, you know, he ended up getting killed or something. So it's just like, the whole story just was really fishy and was not, and basically it was proven to have been a fabrication, make a long story short, that they fabricated this document, and there's no actual evidence ever besides this document that was a fabrication and linked to this, like, defector. There's no evidence of any coordinated plan. And then there's a fudging of the data, because there's a group of researchers, I think it's at the University of Michigan, who did, like, just analyze the census data, and they started to scratch their head, because the official story was something like 800,000 Tutsis killed, but then they looked at the census data, and there weren't that many Tutsis even living in the country, because they had, you know, dated from outside, and there were Francophone Tutsis living in Rwanda, but it was the Anglo Tutsis that had been dated from Uganda. But anyway, there weren't that many Tutsis. So their data, they came to the conclusion, you know, as far as the numbers killed, that there were, you know, a fair number of Tutsi killed, but that a lot of the people killed were actually Hutu. So that challenged the idea that of this Hutu. If it was a coordinated plot of the Hutu to kill all the Tutsi, why did more Hutu die than Tutsi?
If you just think about it for 10 seconds, it doesn't really make sense. You suddenly, in 1994, have this unbelievable massacre that lasted 2 or 3 months, and then suddenly a new president comes in, and then there's peace.
And, well, and Keith Harmon Snow pointed, I mean, the Tutsi on their end, they have a certain, according to his analysis, which I think well-grounded, and, you know, he's done a lot of research, as I pointed out, that they had aspiration of kind of establishing a regional Tutsi empire and hegemony. So they had their own ambition, but then the US-UK had their own agenda, which was to use them to support that. In some way, you can look at like Israel, because the Israelis have their own ambition to establish a kind of greater Israel, and the US has their own objective to use Israel to expand their power and influence, a kind of proxy in the Middle East. So the U.S. has supported that project of Greater Israel. And basically, the U.S. and U.K. were supporting the project of a greater Tutsi empire. And Kagame envisioned himself as this reincarnation of the ancient Tutsi king. Then he would preside over this vast kingdom, excuse me, extending into the Congo. And the US-UK supported this idea because he's functioning as a kind of proxy for them, and he's allowing, you know, he'll open up the Congo for Western corporations, which is the real agenda. And, you know, there was a study that was done that showed that the U.S., it looked at U.S. foreign aid to Uganda to prove how the U.S. was supporting the RPF in the late 80s, 1990, at the time they invaded Rwanda. The studies show that there was a huge spike in U.S. foreign aid to Uganda in that period, like a 200% increase in foreign aid in the year in the late 80s into the early 90s, because Yoweri Museveni, and that was, I think, part of the U.S.-UK design, because Uganda had been ruled by a socialist leader, Milton Obote, in the 60s, and then you had the interlude with Idi Amin, and then Obote came back in, and, you know, he was more leaning to the Soviet Union, China, socialist economy, and he wasn't an ally of the West. So the US-UK supported Yoweri Museveni, who fought a guerrilla war against Obote and took control in Uganda in the mid-80s. And then he was friendly to the RPF and Kagame. So he provided, and Kagame served in Museveni's military intelligence, and he was known for torture. You know, in that war against Obote's forces, he was known for his sadism. And there's a book that shows that there was another leader of the RPF named Fred Wigema, who was more moderate. Well respected, but Kagame had him murdered, according to this book, to take control over the RPF, and was just an evil man, and Machiavellian, and you know, some consider him the worst mass murderer. You know, if you tabulate the number of deaths, I mean, he's killed a lot of his own dissidents, and, you know, sent death squads to kill them in other countries. And, I mean, he's invaded Congo. You know, he's killed numerous heads of state. He may be one of the most murderous leaders the world has ever seen since Adolf Hitler. So we should acknowledge that. He's taken out numerous heads of state, invaded Congo numerous times, presided over, you know, they had to set up open-air crematoria, because they were killing so many Hutu, you know, so that's the level we're dealing with here. And yeah, the Museveni was backing his invasion because, you know, they're kind of very still Rwanda and Uganda. I mean, they've both been in power for decades now, Museveni and Kagame, and they've been very close, and they collaborated on invading and plundering the Congo, which has brought a lot of wealth to both those countries. So Museveni had his own plan, and he was using funneling the U.S. foreign aid to the RPF to strengthen them and prepare them to take over the country. So that was a long plan of the U.S. Empire and British, and then Kagame and Museveni had their own agendas.
You mentioned Israel earlier, and you mentioned Congo. Israeli forces were spotted in Congo, and we know that what's his name, Roger Winter, was working alongside a Mossad agent, Kimcha. Is that right? Yeah, that's right, David Kimcha.
Well, what I found in my research into the history of the CIA was that the CIA developed a program called Operation KK Mountain with the Israeli Mossad, which Mossad was basically set up by James J. Angleton, a famous CIA agent, and was basically an offshoot of the CIA, because Israel has functioned as a proxy of the U.S. empire in the Middle East. Yeah, I don't believe, some believe Israel manipulates U.S. government. Personally, I don't believe that. I think Israel was used for its own purpose of the U.S. empire. There were actually elements in the U.S. government who had been against the U.S. supporting Israel because they felt it would anger other Arab countries and jeopardize U.S. relations with Arab countries and U.S. ability to access and exploit Middle East oil. Such as James Forrestal and Kermit Roosevelt, but they lost out in an internal bureaucratic struggle, and Israel was used as a U.S. proxy and they in the Middle East, and they developed the Operation KK Mountain, whereas the Israeli Mossad did a lot of dirty operations for the CIA, so the U.S. could take a kind of basically what's the term distancing the public. You know, the public doesn't want to think their taxpayers are being used to support these vile dictatorships in Africa, so they use the CIA, you know, to keep it hidden. But on a deeper level, they distance it even further by using the Israelis and setting up this Operation KK Mountain. So Israeli Mossad does a lot of the groundwork, because the under KK Mountain, the Mossad sent operatives to train Mobutu and his forces, and they even directly trained Mobutu in parachuting. He had direct lessons from Mossad operatives, and Mossad operatives were helping to build his security apparatus under this Operation KK Mountain, and they went into other African states like in Cameroon. For instance, they supported the vile regime of Paul Biya, who's now the eldest. He's 92 years old, and he just got reelected. He's been running Cameroon in the interests of France and other foreign interests since the early 80s. And the Israeli Mossad also trained his security apparatus. And it was some of the same people who had been in Congo training Mobutu. So this was a logical extension of the Operation KK Mountain, that Mossad operatives were training and working with Kagame and Museveni to fortify those governments, which were proxies of the U.S. and U.K. And you can argue, I think, within the Zionist movement, because I'm Jewish, I know a lot about the Zionist history. Some would regard how Israel evolved as a complete betrayal of the Zionist movement and the idea that Jews who had been persecuted in Europe should have their own homeland, but they allowed themselves, the Israeli leaders allowed themselves to be used as a proxy by an outside power, the United States, and became involved in all these dirty operations and kind of tainted the whole Zionist project in many ways, and we see that imploding today with a huge percentage of the world and many Jews just shunning Israel because of the dirty things it's been doing. And this has been going on for a long time. A root of it is that it allowed itself to be basically hijacked by a foreign power and to do the dirty work for that foreign power, the United States. And that's seen in the Operation KK Mountain, which is documented. And if you, there are a lot of documents at the National Archives which discuss the Israelis in Africa and how they're coordinating with the CIA. And there are books like Leslie Cockburn wrote a good book on the relationship between the CIA and Mossad called Dangerous Liaison, which is a very good book that was written in the 90s that documents what I'm discussing, this Operation KK Mountain. But so I think what you're saying with the Kagame and the Israeli role is an extension of that Cold War operation.
In the movie Hotel Rwanda, the hotel manager, the real person, I always butcher his name, but I think it's something along the lines of Paul Rusesa Bagina. He was arrested by the Kagame government recently and jailed for 25 years because he was critical of Kagame.
Absolutely, yeah. And it showed how the official narrative was a kind of myth, and that the Kagame was a very vicious government that turned on a lot of its own. And you see that in other totalitarian governments, so sometimes in revolutionary governments, as they evolve more totalitarian structures, they start turning on their own people, you know, who supported the revolution at the beginning, and then they have them killed or throw them in jail. So this exemplified the totalitarian character of the Kagame regime, and he had Rusesabagina, who was a national hero. I mean, I think there's some elements of the official story that are true. I mean, there were, you know, Tutsi who were hunted down, you know, in the context of the Civil War. And I knew, because when I was a student in Boston, a graduate student at Brandeis, and I had a lot of friends from Rwanda, and my roommate was a student at Harvard who was a Tutsi, and he grew up in exile. I met people who were victims. I mean, their stories were legit. You know, they were legitimately victims. These were Tutsi who were victims. So some facets of that story is true, and there were heroic figures who tried, like Rusesabagina, who tried to save people on both sides. Because as we discussed, I mean, there was a lot of killing, and there were Tutsi victims, but there were also a lot of Hutu victims. You know, it wasn't just black and white, one is bad, the other is good. There were killing on both sides in an ugly civil war, and there were heroes who tried to save innocent civilians, like Rusesabagina. And then, yeah, he ends up because Kagame, you know, stayed in power so many years, and was doing so many terrible things. I think he started voicing some criticism, and so he was kidnapped and imprisoned, and by that point he wasn't a young man anymore, and he had some health issues, and he's an older gentleman, and they're imprisoning him while he had these health problems, and he's a national hero, and it took a major effort, I think, I believe he got released, but he was imprisoned for a number of years. And that did get broader awareness that all was not right in Rwanda, and that this simple narrative just didn't make sense. And I mean, I think now Kagame gets a lot more negative press coverage, and there's more awareness that this guy has dictatorial tendencies and has done a lot of terrible things. But for years, he was presented in the media in the most fawning way, up until recently.
And, I mean, he's been the president since 1994.
Exactly. What kind of Bill Clinton gave this speech, and he said, there are three leaders who represent the new face of democracy in Africa, and two of those leaders are still in power now. You know, he gave this speech 30 years ago or more, and two of the leaders are still in power, Museveni and Kagame, and the third was Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, who also, he was accused of genocide against an ethnic minority group, and he also was in power for many years, and was accused of major human rights crimes. And if you look, Kagame and Museveni just have an absolutely abhorrent record. I mean, Museveni has been compared to Idi Amin or worse. There's a book I have by Helen Epstein, who's a very good, I think, a British journalist, who did some good reporting on Uganda about all these people who got killed, who were standing up to Museveni in some way, and then they died in a car accident, and the scene was covered up, and there were all kinds of suspicious deaths of Museveni's opponents. And then Museveni was involved in these invasions of Congo that caused thousands and thousands of deaths and immiseration of the population of Eastern Congo and mass rapes of women. And he was also, he attacked the Northern Akoli people, had supported, Northern Uganda had supported Obote, his opponent. So he took reprisals against the Akoli people, and Ugandan military had been accused of genocide in Northern Uganda. And it's documented. Adam Branch is a British academic who lived in Uganda and wrote an excellent book about the Akoli War, documenting the horrific crime that Museveni's government. And then Kagame, yeah, there's a book by Judy Revers, a Canadian journalist, who interviewed all these people, and she documented the in a lot of detail how these RPF death squads were operating in foreign countries to assassinate opponents of Kagame's government. And there have been, you know, I think a lot of the opposition leaders have been jailed. Like there's this lady, Victoire Ingabire, and she's tried to run against Kagame in various elections, and she's been jailed for over a decade, I believe. So, you know, great democracy, Bill Clinton.
You have the Rwandan Patriotic Front that were the actual primary aggressors. It's an inversion of the Hotel Rwanda story. The Kagame militants, militia, whatever, were backed by CIA, MI6, Mossad. Why?
Very simply, they used them as a proxy to gain more of a foothold in the Congo, which had been ruled by a Western U.S. Proxy, Joseph Mobutu, up until the early 90s. And that's when he got cancer, and he passed away in 1994. So the U.S. is kind of worried, how are we going to retain influence in the Congo and control the diamond wealth? So they concoct this scheme of supporting the RPF. And as you point out, Roger Winter was a key CIA agent who worked under the cover of Refugee Relief Program. And he had worked and he was honored by Kagame, on the 20th or 25th anniversary of the genocide. You know, they had this big ceremony in the National Stadium in Kigali, and Kagame gave a medal to Roger Winter. And he was a CIA operative. And he had mobilized the Kinyarwanda. He had actually funded, the CIA funded Kinyarwanda journals to agitate for, more aggressive RPF and, the Tutsi program. And I guess to try and unite the Tutsi diaspora and to get them to marshal funding for the RPF, but to get them to, some of the journal the CIA was sponsoring, Winter was involved with organizing conferences and getting CIA funding for the journal, was to, I guess, teach youth about the Kinyarwanda history and culture, so that they would be supportive of the RPF and its dream, because I think they viewed Rwanda somewhat like the Jews viewed Israel, kind of holy land, that they had been expelled and thrust into exile by the Hutu, and they had traditionally dominated, been a kind of dominant force going back a generation, more of an aristocracy. So they were used to holding the upper hand over the Hutu, and they couldn't accept being subordinate to them. But yeah, the CIA role was to fund these journals and then to funnel weapons and support through Uganda. The agenda was to use them as a proxy to gain control over the Congo after Mobutu passed away. And France, the Hutu government had been drawn close to France, so it's part of the old great game rivalry. They wanted to muscle out France, assert their control, and gain access to the mineral wealth of the Congo.
Is it still in the West's interest for Kagame to be in power?
Yes, it is. That's why he's still in power, even though he has been exposed as a fraud. And now there are articles you can find that would document that he has committed a lot of human rights abuses, and that clearly he's not a model Democrat. Nobody's going to say that anymore. But I mean, if you look up, the State Department has a website that cataloged the amount of economic and military aid that the U.S. provides to any government in the world. So look up Rwanda, and you'll find that the U.S. is still giving a lot of support to Rwanda, despite of this. And they're still giving a huge amount of support to Uganda, where under Museveni, who's still in power, is this Idi Amin-type leader. And I know the U.S. has direct military bases in Uganda to carry out operations. And they may have military facilities in Rwanda as well. And that's actually one of the myths of the genocide, that the U.S. was a bystander to the genocide, because, in fact, the U.S. was supporting the RPF throughout, from financing them when they were in Uganda, to the U.S. actually sent in troops into Rwanda just in the month that the genocide was occurring. And the troops' real purpose was to ensure that the RPF gained control over the country. It was claimed that it was some kind of humanitarian mission, but there were U.S. troops there at that time, and then military aid to Rwanda was, and that's something I detail in my book on Bill Clinton, Warmonger, in a chapter on Central Africa. The Clinton administration provided a lot of military and intelligence support to the Kagame government right after the genocide and after he consolidated power in the country. And that equipment was used. And the U.S. was actually, there were special U.S. special forces there. and they were assisting the Rwandan invasion of Congo. On the pretext that the RPF had to hunt down the Hutu, who were because they labeled an entire population. The way they framed this genocide enabled them to label all Hutu as responsible for the genocide of the Tutsi, and that justified basically mass extermination of the Hutu, and that was also used as a justification for invading Congo and installing leaders that were pro-Rwanda and pro-U.S. and U.K. And the first leader they installed, Laurent Kabila, was too independent. That's why they ultimately installed this guy, Joseph Kabila, who was adopted by Laurent Kabila, but was actually a Rwandan named Hippolyte Kanembe. And he ruled basically as a Rwandan Quisling from the late 90s through the late 20-teens.
Kagame is getting old. I mean, what happens next?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm sure they're planning. You know, they always plan well in advance. So, and what you find in a lot of, like in Uganda, for instance, I did an article on that, and there was, you know, the U.S. is still heavily supporting the Museveni government, but they're also, like NED has program, National Endowment for Democracy, where they're also supporting the Ugandan opposition with this guy named Bobby Wine, because they want to co-opt the opposition. And, you know, Bobby Wine is not really very progressive in many of his positions. Now, I mean, in the Uganda case, yeah, I mean, he has faced persecution in some of his supporters, but he has a very vapid political program. He basically would, you know, continue the same kind of neoliberal formula and allow, you know, he doesn't have a Pan-African or socialist, vision. That's what the CIA and U.S. and U.K. governments are against. They want to make sure the opposition does not become led by socialists or Pan-Africanists. The reason, because the socialists would nationalize industry and establish national control over the resort, either a socialist or more left-leaning, with a left-leaning economic program of reestablishing economic sovereignty and trying to develop the industry on their own terms, and a Pan-African vision of that was the vision of Kwame Nkrumah and Julius Nyerere and other leaders of the 60s and 70s.
Gaddafi.
Who wanted to, what's that? Gaddafi, yeah.
Also Gaddafi.
Gaddafi. That's why they took out Gaddafi, yeah. Because they wanted to unify the African states so they could strengthen their economy and, together, work together build their economy and establish control over their own economy and establish strong military so they can combat any Western interference. And that's what the West does not want. So they'll co-opt the opposition. They'll support a Bobby Wine type who's not a leftist or a Pan-Africanist, who's just a kind of, you know, he doesn't really have much of a vision. He's just against the dictatorship. And he has a following among youth. He's a hip-hop artist, and he's a cool guy, and, you know. people like him personally, and so he has a big following on social media and stuff. So that's the guy there, because he doesn't have this larger vision. So when Museveni's time is up, and there may be Museveni, I think, is trying to groom his son Muhoozi, but he's got a really tainted record. He was spearheading a lot of the atrocities of Congo and northern Uganda, and is known a brutal guy. So I don't know. The CIA and U.S., they're smart. They realize the stakes here, so they're covertly supporting the opposition, and they could build them up as time goes on. So I imagine the same thing is going on in Rwanda. I mean, I don't know. We don't get any news about that. It's really a totalitarian society there. One of the most oppressive governments. There's no dissent at all, so it's hard. There really is no opposition to Kagame. The main opposition are in jail, like Victoire Ingabire is in jail. So I don't know who. And there was a hip hop. I did an article. There was a hip hop artist who's gaining a lot of following in Rwanda. Who's a very talented singer, and he had some lyrics critical of Kagame, and he was murdered. So I mean, they're murdering any. I mean, that's going, I think, beyond Uganda is also totalitarian, but there is some underground dissent, and it's repressed to some extent, but it's there. But Rwanda, we don't hear much because they're being jailed, they're being killed. So I don't know. Kagame is probably trying to groom his son. His son went to Harvard. From what I understood, his son. They're not that intelligent. Like, Kagame didn't have a college degree, and his son failed at Harvard. He was not the best student at all. So these aren't the brightest, but they're just the most ruthless. And, he may be trying to bring in his son. And I don't know, if there's no strong opposition, I don't know what the U.S. government will do. They may go along with his son if he's still serving certain U.S. interests. And then there's China. The equation is that Congo is drawn somewhat close to China, and China has huge interests and investments as far as in Africa and the mining industry. And China has become much more popular than the West because they actually develop a lot of infrastructure in Africa. They build many things, stadiums, roads, ports,
airports,
railways. Yeah, so I mean, more and more African governments are turning to China, and so the U.S. and U.K. are losing the great game, so they're more and more desperate to cling on to some of these kind of leaders who have served their agenda for years. So whoever Kagame tries to groom as a successor, the U.S. may go along with, and I don't know if there would be a revolution because they've thoroughly crushed any opposition and driven a lot of the Hutu out of the country and exterminated. I mean, that is genocide. They've exterminated a lot of the Hutu, so how could they take power back when they've been exterminated, driven out of the country, and completely weakened?
It's another interesting side fact. I mean, China is remarkably sovereign. Most African countries are not.
Well, that's true, yeah. And I mean, there is a. I spent a bit of time in Africa, particularly in Zambia. And there's a much different attitude toward China compared to Western, colonial power, or white power like the United States, because of China's history. I think you were making the point in our discussion earlier that China is completely misunderstood in Western countries.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Maoist revolution, whatever its flaws, it was viewed as an authentic nationalist anti-colonial revolution in a lot of the world, because China had been a neo-colony of Great Britain, and that was China was humiliated. It was the century of weakness, in the 19th century, when China became a neo-colony of Great Britain. And that was the underlying purpose of the Maoist revolution, was to overcome that century of humiliation and establish their sovereignty as a country and stand up to outside powers. And, the nationalists that the communists fought were supported very heavily by the United States, Chiang Kai-shek. So Mao was an authentic revolutionary hero in a lot of the so-called third world and countries subjected to colonization. And then China, from the Maoist period, invested a lot of money in supporting development projects in Africa. So like in Zambia, the Chinese helped build the Tanzanian-Zambia Railway. So the attitude toward the Chinese are much more positive, although there was some negative from my experience staying there. In the mining sector, the Chinese didn't uphold very high labor standards. They brought some of their own laborers, and when it came to the local laborers, there were some very bad workplace conditions, and there were some incidents of miners and African being killed that aroused some anti-China sentiment. However, overall, there still is a certain respect for China. And then what China's doing now is that they are putting a lot back in, although they take out a lot of the mineral wealth. And, you know, ideally, Africans themselves would have control, you know, complete ownership and control over the mining sector. However, if you compare other, you know, different foreigners, the Chinese reinvest a lot of the money. And so, like in Zambia, they built a beautiful athletic facility. They upgraded the railway. They're building roads. And I know they're doing that everywhere throughout Africa. So it's you know, they're bringing a lot of goodwill. And toward, you know, there's much more positive attitudes. And so that's why I say the U.S. Is losing the great game, because the U.S. doesn't do the same thing. You know, they don't advance those kind of projects, which bring real improvements to the society. And, I mean, the U.S. is known for building all these drone bases, and that is just for Africans, that symbolizes like an ugly return to a past colonial age, where you have this foreign white country putting these horrific drone bases in their country, and it showed that they've compromised their sovereignty, and it's fueling instability and violent cycles. You know, the U.S. war on terror has just fueled the growth of Islamic terrorism and destabilized a lot of countries, like especially in the more northern, you know, Horn region, like Somalia, Kenya, and some of these countries are experiencing problem with Islamic fundamentalism that they never had before, including in West Africa. And that's, you know, studies have shown that terrorism has spiked massively because of the U.S. war on terror and the drone attacks. So the attitude toward the U.S. is very, very negative, whereas China, there's some mixed feelings, but there's a lot of positive feelings because of the history and because of the tangible development projects that the Chinese support. We're still living in the remnants of the colonial era, and a lot of the African economies are still dominated, and the major wealth is being siphoned out of Africa into these huge Anglo-American corporations. I think at the root of the Rwandan conflict is to try and maintain that control. And, you know, South Africa and the Congo are the two richest countries in Africa as far as their mineral wealth.
I don't know if you know about the huge airport that the Chinese helped build in Ethiopia. Probably one of the biggest airports on the continent, and it's acting kind of as an African version of Dubai.
Well, absolutely. And this is bringing tremendous progress and development to Africa, and it's creating a huge number of jobs. And I think that's why we're seeing this hysterical U.S. reaction to China, because China's winning. You know, China's winning the great game throughout the world, and the U.S. is losing. I mean, the U.S. has waged all these wars in recent years that have been rooted in lies, that have caused a huge amount of death and destruction. The U.S. Society itself is coming undone. It's been plagued by, you know, mass shootings, homeless rates approaching depression levels. There's a level of social breakdown within the United States, and people around the world can see this, and they can see also how China, as you were saying at the beginning, is blossoming. That they have very efficient public transportation. The quality of life of Chinese is improving dramatically every year. And the Chinese government has helped lift millions out of poverty. So The U.S. is losing the great game. So how did they respond? Through a huge military buildup and advancement of this xenophobic rhetoric and threatening China with a world war and building up military bases in Pacific Islands to provide the infrastructure for potential war on China. But it's going to fail. I mean, war is politics by other means. If the U.S. is losing the political game, they're not going to win the military game. And China has very advanced military technology superseding the United States. So the United States would be wise to look at China, some of the good thing that it's done, and try and emulate it and to live in the reality and to adapt, because the United States still has a very strong economy. It has well-trained workforce and good universities, and it has abundant natural resources. So it's best to harness China's economic growth to its own growth, to try and work with China for, and that's what Xi Jinping proposed about 8 or 10 years ago. He called for a win-win strategy of cooperation with the United States, and that would be the best approach for the U.S. To follow. Unfortunately, since the Obama administration initiated the pivot to Asia, the U.S. is going the opposite direction of encircling China militarily and threatening it with a war. But related to Africa, more and more African countries were turning away from the Western orbit. You know, we see that in Burkina Faso and in Western Africa, where there were a number of coups against pro-Western puppet-type governments, and they're trying to reassert their autonomy and reassert the old Pan-Africanist tradition of the Nkrumah, the Harare, Thomas Sankara. Those are authentic African revolutionary leaders who are all overthrown by the West, but they are viewed very positively in Africa, and I think there'll be a new generation. And this generation, I think, will be more, you know, will be able to withstand Western pressure better, because the West is in decline. And so, again, my advice in the West is that we should adapt to the new world order to try and sustain more prosperous economy and society. And the path of imperialism and the warfare state has not served the interest of the American public. That's perhaps another discussion, but has not served the interest well of the American public, as well as these countries that have been plundered, like we've been discussing, like Congo, or these wars that have been provoked by these kind of imperialist policies. Because there was a possibility in Rwanda, there was a peace-sharing agreement, the Arusha Accords, that Habyarimana was willing to abide by, that could have averted all this bloodshed, some kind of power sharing between Hutu and Tutsi, and it would have avoided the bloodshed that extended into Congo.
So the moral of the story, Jeremy, is when you watch Hotel Rwanda, understand that it's typically Hollywood fiction infused with a little bit of truth. So when it starts off by saying based on a true story.
Yeah, well, I think one of the moral is that the unfortunate thing is it feeds this kind of innate racism in the West. Oh, look at these African savages killing each other like that, and you know. And you know, if you don't understand the broader geopolitics, if you don't understand the, you know, the way that the U.S. and U.K. were involved in manipulating this conflict, and the way that it was distorted, then you can easily revert to these kind of stereotypes. And so that's why, you know, education is important beyond just watching a movie on this topic, and hopefully the education system. I think that's one of the failings in the U.S. As well, is not just the media and Hollywood, but the education system should better educate youth about African political reality and about the role that the West has played in destabilizing a lot of African countries. But that is very rarely covered adequately, even in universities. I think you wouldn't get any, very few high schools cover it at all or with any adequacy, and unfortunately, very few universities. And that's a subject maybe for another show, but I've done some shows and articles on how the CIA and U.S. government agencies have taken over a lot of higher education, and the teaching of political science and history is often distorted, and there are only a small number of A lot of the professors are denied tenure or fired if they teach the true story and the true history. So that's, I think, part of the tragedy. And then the Western public just reverts to certain racial stereotypes over and over again.
How can my audience follow your work?
You can follow my work at Covert Action Magazine, www.covertactionmagazine.com, or my Substack, Jeremy Kuzmarov at Substack, Too Hot for the Mainstream Media. And I also have a podcast and show on radio that has its own Substack called Uncontrolled Opposition. And you can go to my website, jeremykuzmarov.com, and that has my books.
Jeremy Kuzmarov, thank you for joining me in the trenches.